You're listening to CivCast on the Kyle Dempster Studios Network. Support us on Patreon at patreon.com/CivCast. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to a new episode of CivCast. My name is Kyle, and I'm joined here by my co-host, as always, Dan. Hello, Dan.
Hello, sir. You have friends today.
I have friends today. I'm not solo. I cried last week for hours. Thanks for leaving me, guys. Oh, and speaking of friends, plural, we're joined by our other co-host, Wouter. Hello, Wouter. Where are you there? I'm trying to point at you.
Hello, guys. It's so good to be back.
You guys, Wouter, you are out forever. You were just like, I'm never coming back ever again. But then we got you.
Yeah,
here.
I got fired from the show, and now they realize how much they missed me, so I got rehired.
So basically, it turns out I fired Wouter, and then I fired Dan, and then I realized it's you can't do it as a one-man band. So I came.
So he brought us back.
Yep.
That's how that happens. I'm kidding. No, that's not how any of it happened. Life caught up to us. Life is crazy. I was just thinking, my job's getting crazy too. We're kind of talking about this off air, but people are going back to school soon, and I work at a community college, so it is like all hands on deck. I feel bad. I've been a little silent on our subreddit and such, but I've been getting many, many ducks in one single row. So now that all the ducks are aligned, they do that whatever ducks do.
Yeah, well, August is a busy month.
It is. It really is. Dan, how are things with you? You teach at a university. How's that affect things for you?
Well, I mean, it's a prep month for me, so I'm putting together all the syllabuses or syllabi and prepping stuff for the fall. So it's not the busiest month for me, I'm not going to lie. And then I'm going to get a week or two off here in the very near future before September rolls along. So the past couple of weeks have been busy for me, but I don't think I don't think that the next couple of weeks are, but I'm pretty sure they will be for other reasons.
So. Yes, you have some good reasons for that. So if we lose Dan here on a couple episodes upcoming, worry not. All good things. So, Dan, while we still have you and while we have our listeners who want to hear about all things Civ, do you want to tell them about the CivCast Challenge for the month of August? They are running out of time quickly.
Yeah, the CivCast Challenge for the month is a naval challenge. So we have put our considerable intellect, and that's in quotations, together to try and give you something where you are going to be forced, pigeonholed into focusing on the Navy for your playthroughs. So for your Civ, you're going to pick one of six Civs that we have set aside as being the most strong navally. And those would be Australia, Brazil, Japan, Norway, England, and Spain. And you choose one of those six as your own Civ. And then you customly set the five opposing Civs that you're going up against as the five remaining. So if you choose Spain, for instance, the five you're going to go against are England, Norway, Australia, Brazil, and Japan. So it's the six Civs that we think have the best bias for, you know, a water-focused game for sure. The map is going to be the Island Plates map, which is probably the one that encourages movement and movement by sea the most, and it discourages isolationism insofar as best we can, because we wanted you to get out there and actually engage the naval parts of the game. The map size is six person, which is a small size map. Everything is pretty standard. The speed and the resources and the starting age are all your normal standard things there. Your victory type. So we wanted to make sure that the game was one where you were actually forced to go out there and explore and engage and not just kind of seal yourself off on your little island and, you know, build your way towards a culture victory or a scientific victory without, you know, actually being out there and, you know, engaging the naval part, which is what we've constructed this challenge for. So your victory types are going to be either religious or domination, because they're the ones that encourage you to go out and make friends / enemies as much as possible. So those are going to be your victory types. Yeah, one of the two, you set them both as contingent. And other than that, yeah, your difficulty is emperor, which is kind of a standard for us. We've been doing emperor for a while now. And, you know, as usual, as you're doing it, please be sure to post your stuff, your pictures, your stories, your scenarios in the subreddit that we have up on r/civcast. And as you do that, I believe next week is the conclusion of it. It concludes on the 26th. So next week, I'll be reading out your stories. And as of right now, we have a couple that have posted on there, which are definitely going to get highlighted next week. We would love to see some more. Last month, we had like 12 or 13 or something, so I had to rip them off in rapid succession. Our hope is that this month we can get something similar. So if you guys can get there and can make sure that you're participating in this, make sure that you get a good crack at it for the month. And then let us know, too, not just necessarily how your game went, but what you think of this changed and altered naval combat, which has become, I think we talked about how it was certainly a focal point of the last patch, and to me has become a focal point of the game, more so at least than I remember Civ 5 being. I see Civ 6's naval combat as being stronger, more comprehensive, and just altogether more fun. So hopefully you guys find the same. Let us know in the subreddit, though.
Yes, please do let us know. Like Dan said, head over there, civcast.reddit.com, post your victory. I know we had Resender say he tried and was still struggling to get done with this because people are saying this one's challenging. So that's good. That's Valter and I were saying it is supposed to be a challenge. So
it is called the Civcast Challenge.
Yeah,
for a reason.
If you even just tell us where you stand with it. We want to hear how things are going. Okay, guys, we have a bunch to talk about this week because we haven't talked in a while. Last time that Dan and I were together on here, I was talking to him about my initial thoughts on Nubia, playing with them, because I had not too much time with them at the moment. I think it might have been a couple days, but I had really fun games with them, really liked some of the changes that I was seeing. And then, I don't know, we went through, were we all three here together? We were all together when we first went through the patch notes. But what we haven't done is talked about what things stand out to people the most. So I figured I'd throw it to you too, Valter. Maybe you want to start with telling me like a key thing. Is there one thing? How about this? I'll ask you specifically. What is the one patch? I already know the answer, damn it. What is the one thing that has stood out most to you when it comes to these patch note changes that has influenced your game?
My complete military game has changed. Like, it is not even close to what it was before. And that, to me, is a huge difference.
I realize this is immediately. You're referring to the Siege Tower change.
Yes. And I actually am coping with that change, as in I'm not using Siege Towers at all anymore all of a sudden. Even in a period where they are useful. Mm. But I switched to a large army of a lot of ranged units. And it might also be because the first couple of times that I played with this patch was with Nubia, who is awesome for ranged units. Mm-hmm. But I also saw it bleeding through in my other games where I'm also spamming out more ranged units than I usually did and using them to batter down cities before I take them with my two horsemen or something like that.
Uh-huh. I mean, that's what I was saying to Dan, is how much I freaking loved Nubia's emphasis on ranged units, because, you know, I've made it it's no secret that I very much loved that class of unit in the past, and to have them get a highlight, like especially in this case, Nubia and I, we're good friends already. Dan, I don't know how much time you've had to play, but have you experienced a change that has really stood out to you, even if it's something that you are watching? You mentioned you were watching some Quill 18 playthroughs, but any of these patch notes that really have, you know, stuck with you after 2 weeks or something like that?
Last time I played, I was with Spain, as we talked about, because I really wanted to see the Treasure Fleet changes. And, I mean, it's something I think with the international trade gold being boosted from +4 to +6 is something that you really only see the benefit from when you're compounding it. So I had 8 civs in the game. And when I left off, it's not something that you necessarily like jumps out to you or that you notice right away, like a unit change or something like what happened with Siege Towers. But I think compounding, as it gets into the later game, I'm definitely going to notice probably that +2 bonus, because I'm so heavy when I play Spain with the international trade anyway, that it's definitely going to help me on the accumulator side. Plus the missions with the +1 science to +2 science if next to a campus. Missions are great buildings if you're, or at least were great buildings, you're playing a specific style. Now this kind of plus two science bonus actually makes them kind of viable, even if you're not going for a religious play. So me trying to play this active science victory as I'm trying to do in this game right now, it allows me to, you know, focus on missions in the right situation. I have to build them next to a campus, but it makes them viable as a building to assist with a science victory, whereas before it just seemed like kind of a token plus one boost for people who weren't going religious at all. So overall, I know I talked about this 2 weeks ago, last time I was on, but I really like the buffs to Spain and the bonuses to Spain, and I'm going to play this one through to see if come end game, it's the accumulator really, really benefits me, and to see if it's something I really notice.
Yeah, I think that some of these changes, you guys can shoot me down if I'm wrong, because this is a very generalizing statement here, but I feel like some of these changes, maybe more so than ones we've gotten in the past, have felt a little bit like closer. They don't seem like we've got such a huge spike. Now, Valter, in your case, we have one that changed your whole military gameplay. But I feel like a lot of these wound up being more minute tweaks, but a lot of them across the board. I think some that even look very small in text, but have actually added bigger changes throughout. Like I did notice that 10% cost of increased cost of district buildings. I noticed that a tiny bit, or at least, I don't know, maybe placebo effect. Maybe it just seemed like I noticed it, but it did feel like in some of my playthroughs that was, it was like, okay, this is a couple extra turns than I would expect on quick. I'm trying to think what else I really encountered in here that stood out, but
I mean, when you're talking about that increased cost, don't forget the increased per settler cost bump by 50%. That's a lot. It became a lot higher. Because we were short on time the first time we went over them all. And that is also a very big part in this patch that actually nerfs going wide a little bit more, which we have talked about in the past as well. Like maybe going wide is a bit too easy. And it's become a little bit more difficult. Not still like you shouldn't do it, but it became a bit better.
You know, I don't disagree with that at all, but I will say for the game that I played, I didn't seem to notice that increase. For as large as it is, I just didn't feel like I noticed, well, I guess so it is an increased, so increased cost of district buildings by 10% and increased per settler cost bump. So that means per settler that you make, they get an increased production cost of 50%. Am I reading that correctly?
I think what they did is like every time you build another city, the cost of the building goes up, and the amount
the cost
that
of
it
the
went
district
up by
goes up.
The district buildings in this case.
Oh, okay, okay.
And so the cost that it went up by, for example, could be 2% or something like that. Yeah. I don't know the actual number, but if it was 2%, it now became 3%. If it was 10%, it became 15%.
Aha. Okay. So that does explain, I think, what I was noticing. I don't really remember if it was the buildings that bothered me so much as just, yeah, I guess it was. I guess it had to be the buildings. Because, okay, so that explains that. Do you guys like that idea of capping it down and making it so we're not all playing wide? I mean, those are just two different play styles for people in general. I don't know. I mean, playing wide has obvious bonuses in the sense that you have more production hubs, but is this a good thing? Dan, do you have thoughts on this?
Playing wide is, I mean, I felt like we've talked about this a couple times. I think I felt like playing wide was kind of how this was skewing. And I think a clamp down on it, it's not necessarily a clamp down. I think that to balance it like that is always a good idea, because I thought they did a really great job in Civ 5 of really allowing you to go in either direction because of the weird policy tree setup. Not weird, it was a good policy tree setup that they had there. But obviously the changes they've made to the fundamentals of 6 have kind of skewed it in one direction. I do think personally, just to what you guys were talking about before, the increased cost of districts buildings by 10%, I notice it when I first start building districts, I think, but later on in the game, so far it hasn't been something that's really stood out to me or something that has impacted me much. The per settler cost bump by 50%, I guess I don't really quite understand the mechanic as well, even after your explanation there. I don't think I've noticed that as much.
I mean, I've noticed that the buildings became more expensive, and I also have noticed that the districts themselves became cheaper. And I like that. I like the fact that the district itself became a bit cheap and the buildings a bit more expensive. in my mind, that's a good change, because I would like to plop down the district sooner rather than later, just mm-hmm. to make sure that I don't put anything else there, for example, because district placement is such an important factor in the game. It became a bit easier that way. But I think I have noticed the district buildings being more expensive, especially when they're pillaged. That also became annoying then.
That's interesting, because I don't think I dealt with that in my game. So that's a very interesting one. So when you're trying to rebuild and fix stuff up, yeah, that extra increased cost would be a little bit of a thorn in the side, for lack of a better word, because you're spending extra production just to repair something you've already built.
Exactly. So that's another side effect of the fact that the district buildings became more expensive, not the district itself. Because the district itself, that's relatively easy to repair, but the buildings usually cost a little bit more.
Right.
And now that they are even more expensive, it is even worse when things get pillaged. For example, by a spy. Spies are still awesome, man.
That's what I meant to say, by the way. I don't know if I said districts are more expensive, but I meant the buildings, and I can elaborate on that if need be. But yeah, what you say is pretty in line with my thinking.
Yeah.
So one thing I actually want to put a call out to listeners that play and do multiplayer games specifically. Have you noticed any improved stability after this latest patch? Because they claim to make fixes to it, and I have not played a multiplayer game of Civ 6 in a long time. So, and when I did, I didn't have any multiplayer join issues. So if you're one of those people out there that was trying to play with friends, I would love to hear if you've had any improvement, because that'd be a good thing to kind of crowdsource an answer from. We just typically don't play multiplayer here. So I really want to know about that. Anyone notice anything better when it comes to the AI dealings? Anything that stood out to you two? Have they been easier to work with, or have you had more like weird glitchy things when it comes to their trade deals? Because I heard whispers and rumors of it being strange when dealing with them.
Embassies. I feel like they always accept embassies now.
Hallelujah.
I had people actually making demands at me, which was interesting. Oh,
you can screw off right now. You're not getting anything from me. Do you give in to those demands?
That was usually my reaction, but just the sheer fact that they actually did it surprised me significantly.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that I don't think I had any demands, but I did notice a different amount of trade deals coming through. Like I can't exactly identify how they were different, but they seemed, the ones that I got seemed a little bit more enticing than usual. I actually looked at the deals, but then what I unfortunately heard, I believe this was on the Civ Reddit subreddit, was people saying that they were getting terrible deals, like hugely undercut deals. Have you guys gotten any of those?
No, my deals have been pretty standard, what I normally would trade for and stuff like that. So
good.
I don't think I've noticed that much.
So weird anomalies across the board then. Fair enough. What else? Anyone have anything else that really stands out to them?
I think one thing that I really noticed is that the Congo all of a sudden became a lot less powerful. Usually when they are in the game, they take it away quite easily. They stand out above the other civs quite easily. But apparently the nerf to their great people points really hurt them harder than I imagined when I read the patch notes, because they somehow don't end up at the top all the time anymore.
That is true. I don't, it makes me sad. Go ahead, Dan.
There is one thing I noticed, and it's such a quality of life boost that I completely forgot was in the notes, and that I should think completely forgot was new. But now the trade route automatically reselects the route it had before, which,
yes,
good God, when you reach like mid-game and you have all your trade routes get dispersed around there, and especially late-game, I would imagine, oh my God, is that like a relief? Does that not help exponentially?
Quality of life changes.
It's still not as good as the mods are, unfortunately. I kind of had hoped, since they did some update to it, that they would make it like sortable by production, for example, or that. But it's a start.
Yeah, that's exactly what I've heard is, you know, it has not really replaced. I mean, the mod is really good, and I can't think of the name of it. What's Trade Route Advanced or something like that? I think it's the mod.
It is some of the mod packs as well, like
it's like the top one,
I think.
Oh, The one I used was great, and it wasn't updated at the time, so I couldn't use it. It's probably updated now. Probably got updated very, very quickly. But it was such a good trade route mod, because what they still are lacking, correct me if I'm wrong, is you can't sort by what you're trying to send to. So if you want the most gold or culture or whatever, production, you can't search by that or sort by it. So that sucks. I don't know why that's not a feature they add. It shouldn't be hard to do that one filter. Excel can do it.
Like I said, since they did some work on it, they should have probably done that as well, because it is clearly something that people want.
Yeah.
And it's clearly something that people have been complaining about as well, that it's not there. And especially since mods so easily can fix it, it shouldn't take them that much effort either.
So without steering too far away from these show notes and anything like that, I think this is just a healthy conversation and a little bit of a check-in I want to have with you guys. So for the past... This was our first, I would say, drought between getting any sort of patch. In the early spring, they were really on it. For a game that came out in October of 2016, they were very quick to put out new patches, new DLC, etc., etc. However, after we got, Alexander was our last DLC before we got this one, I think. I think it was Alexander. We had long drought.
Cyrus.
Yes. Thank you. Alexander and Cyrus. And then we had this like weirdly long drought where it felt like we had no news or anything like that. Where do you guys feel like we stand these days with Firaxis's attention to the game as it currently stands? We were wondering if we were going to get an expansion this year. Obviously, we had our doubts. But at the same time, we knew when they didn't announce anything at E3 over the summer, we knew that was highly unlikely. Do you guys feel like they are still as attentive to it, or are you thinking their dev teams are focused on the next new expansion and now we're kind of getting the little breadcrumbs that are just tossed aside?
Well, it's a lot of content, I think, for the first year. I hope people appreciate that the level in terms of how many downloadable civs they put out, and in terms of the actual patches themselves, I know we had a bit of a dry spell here in between these two most recent patches, but to me, it's a lot of content. I don't remember the cycle of Civ 5 being this, this active, especially in the beginning. But you know, this is an era in video game production where devs are dropping games from update cycles almost immediately if they're not doing what they want in terms of sales and in terms of people playing the game. For instance, I saw yesterday that EA has officially stopped doing updates on the new Mass Effect game, and it's only 5 months after they released the game. So things like that are really alarming to me when I read about that in the community, because that tells me that gaming companies are now ready to drop IPs that are not performing above and beyond their expectations. I don't know how Civ 6 has been in terms of sales. I do know in terms of people actually playing the game that it definitely had a spike when it was released, and then it had a bit of a lull, and then it's kind of evened off a bit. So I hope that Firaxis is ready to take their lumps between now and when the next expansion comes, and just that people are okay with the fact that, you know, stuff until you get expansions, stuff is going to be pretty minor. Although in saying that, I don't think what they've done in this first cycle, this first year, has been minor. I think they've overhauled it, listened to feedback, given us a lot of new content, and been overall, I've been pretty satisfied with what they've done.
Yeah, I can only agree completely with what Dan said. Every DLC has been accompanied with a patch that actually solved issues that we were suffering from. And we are still having one extra DLC being promised in the near future as well, for those who did a digital deluxe edition for free for them.
Yep.
So we know that there is still something in the works. And it won't come out this month, of course, but in the near future, maybe the full patch, as they will probably call it, we will have at least that to look forward to. And I think that is the right amount of things that we can expect from them whilst they are working in the background, hopefully on a true full expansion.
Which I'm very excited for. So our next DLC, I believe, is a South Pacific Civ, I think is what we're looking for. So we guessed like the Indonesian areas or something like that. TBD what that actually is. But Dan, to your point about questioning the sales of Civ 6, I don't have the best metrics here, but I just wanted to tack on that PC Games N, this is back in November of 2016, so about a month less than a month after launch, they had said that Civ 6 sells over a million units to become fastest selling in the franchise, which is a good thing. I mean, you want to continue your sales every game iteration, but we know that people were, what's a polite way to put this? People were not necessarily ready to jump ship from Civ 5 to Civ 6 super readily. You know, they had hesitations, especially with Civ 5's rocky launch in the past, that some may claim that game wasn't even shelf ready until, you know, a whole another expansion or many patches later. So yeah, for it to outsell that game, you know, any of the other games in the franchise within about a month, that is great. That is really, really good. And I have to commend them, like you two both said, so I'm echoing you, but I have to commend them on their attention to detail. I think that all of the leaders that they've put out and civilizations that they've put out through these DLC packs have not only been quality made, but they've been interesting. They've had unique features to them. Some of them more so, clearly more so than others. Some of them, you know, just had way better stat things, like Australia with their Outback Station. Hard to beat that. But still, these guys are very unique guys and gals, because they've continued to, you know, try and push for a little gender equality in their patches as well. I'd say that they've been doing a great job on it, but I like this idea of kind of checking in every couple months so we can kind of discuss their cycle of releases. Because Dan, like you said, we live in we've had this conversation before. Valter, you've said, I think we're kind of in a golden age of video games. I tend to be a little bit more of a pessimist with it, because I fear what Dan said about seeing too many IPs drop too quickly, and that scares me a little bit. But I think Firaxis is doing a really good job. They're sticking to their guns.
Yeah, I mean, we're definitely in a green age of video games, because they're making more money than I think people realize. And I think the industry itself is just insanity right now. But I think if we listen back to the episodes we had in the early cycle of the game, Kyle, when the game was first released, we were loving the game. You and I remember we would talk about our tone and tenor in those discussions was we loved it. And I think that the fact that, I mean, I don't think I've necessarily cooled to it. I definitely in the past month or so have not played it nearly as much as A, I would like, and B, I did in the past. But I don't think that has anything necessarily to do with the game itself. I think that with games like this, as with any real-time strategy game, you play it and maybe you play it to death a little bit for a time, and then you take a break from it until something, you know, inspires you and until you get the passion to come back. And that is what them constantly coming up with patches and new DLC does, right? It refreshes it. And I do know for our listenership, we've had people who have come and gone in the Reddit interacting with us. And I'm sure they've gone through the same cycle as we have. And, you know, all I could say is that if they keep on this current path and this current patch release and DLC release cycle, they'll do a great job of refreshing and renewing and bringing people back on like a monthly basis. There will always be the diehards, people, you know, who play the game, you know, all day, not all day, every day, but they play the game like constantly every week. And that's fantastic. I'm not going to pretend that I have the ability to be that right now. But I do know that when a game intrigues me, like the game did at its launch, and like Civ 5 did by the end of its dev cycle, I'll play it more than I play any other game. So kudos to them for, you know, trying to keep it refreshed and trying to keep it new and giving us new content every couple months, because I think that's what you need to do in this extremely cluttered video game world right now to engage people and to keep people loyal to your product.
I think that's very well said, Dan. And I have to say, I personally caught flack in the earlier days of the CivCast podcast, which is fine. It's totally fine. People are saying Kyle needs to play more Civ 6. But the thing is, guys, I know how I do with video games. And if I force myself to play one video game for too long, I will burnout. And that's the fear. Like, that's what I never want to happen, right? So I don't always play Civ. But what I can say, to again echo all the points you just made, is they do a very good job, they being Firaxis, of putting out new content and new interesting things that keep me coming back and keep me excited to check the news. Whether or not I'm actually booting up the game on a weekly basis, I love staying on top of it. And I can tell you, guaranteed, there are many, many games that I've claimed that I've loved in the past that I don't monitor any news for anymore. Just because, life and, you know, you move away from things. But that is a testament to what Firaxis does, that the game is good enough, or, you know, however you want to say it, it's great enough that it has me coming back for more and always excited to see what it is. I would say this game's like a legacy game for me, in the sense that that's why I felt comfortable making a podcast about it, because I played Civ 5 for its entirety of its run, really. And sure, I got terribly bored with it at points and I didn't pick it up for, you know, 3 to 6 month cycles. But when I came back to it, I eagerly came back. There are many games that people go back to that I still have in my Steam library. Like, as much as I love Skyrim, I don't ever really go back to Skyrim. I haven't gone back to Skyrim in like 2 years. Just saying, you know, comparison wise, that game's great. I love it, but I don't play it. And I honestly don't stay on top of any news that comes out about it either. So that just, again, I guess I'm just throwing weight behind what you said, that their releases and their update cycles and they have an interestingly different community than many video games. It's a more strategic based community. Their way of promoting things on social media is very different. They go with a more, I would say, like intellectual history focused posts than, you know, some that are more about screen caps. They just have a different audience and they know how to keep them engaged, I would say. So kudos to you for Firaxis. Love ya. Anyone else have anything to say, Wouter? You are a major fan of this game.
The Civilization series is my favorite gaming series ever. I've been playing since 3 and I literally died for 4. And 5 in the beginning, I hated so much I didn't touch it until like the first expansion. But I have already 400 hours in Civ 6, wow. And that's only going to rise more. And it will easily bypass Civ 5 hours of playtime. I currently have double the hours in Civ 5, but I will manage before Civ 7 comes out. I will have easily passed that amount.
I will say to that point, Wouter, that I don't have very many hours in Civ 6. We kind of talked about this before. I don't know if I want to bring the downer to the party here, but because I think you guys helped me realize what the issue was. And I have to say, whatever it is with Civ 6, I think it is a pretty flawless game, in my opinion. But something is still missing, and I hope this something gets remedied in the expansion. But you guys made me realize that what I feel like I'm missing in this is kind of memories of good games. I'm not having those games that really stand out. So I don't know how they fix that. But I think for me, that's what's keeping me under. My hours for this are not great. I'm only in like the 160 some hours of Civ 6, I think. It's surprising because I've had another game surpass it more recently. And it's a game I feel like I care for a lot less. And I don't know what that means. Dan, you had a comment.
Here's what you do. You carve out like a Saturday or a Sunday or whatever your weekend is, one day, and you say to yourself in the morning, "All right, I'm gonna play a full Civ game. Like I was a kid. I'm gonna sit down and I'm gonna commit to playing a full game over like 6 to 8 hours. I'm gonna order pizza. I'm gonna have some pops or some adult pops or whatever beside me, ready to go. And I'm just gonna sit here. I'm gonna have a good time. I'm gonna pause when I need to, but I'm gonna play through a full game." That's how you create one of those memorable games. I can't create a memorable game that I'm going into once or twice a week where I'm popping in and popping out, because then I lose, you know, everything that goes along with it. I lose the intensity, or I lose the motivation, or I lose the strategic elements of something that I had planned on the Monday, but I don't come back to the game till the Thursday. That's what I found, at least going back to Civ 5, which I did play a lot more intensely than 6, I think, that I would do if I wanted to create one of those memorable games, is I'd start the game at 10 a.m. and then I'd play it till like 5 or 6 p.m. Unfortunately, I don't have the ability to necessarily do that anymore. I don't know if any of us do, but that's how you create memorable games in my mind, is you pull full games out of a day.
That's a great point, Dan. So I think what I'm getting from yours is maybe it's less about the game. Maybe it's the fact that we're all just getting older. Even Copper Cutters in chat says, "So true, damn real life." And I have to admit.
Well, yeah. I mean, unfortunately, you know, maybe if we were 16, 17, 18 again, which is the golden age of my gaming time, I would have 800 hours on Civ 6 to this point. I probably wouldn't have a life either, but you know, you balance those two things, because Civ 6 to me is, as we've talked about, a better game out of the gate than Civ 5, and I would frankly love to have more time to give to it. Instead, I'll commit that time to the theoretical and to the studying of it in some cases than I actually do to the playing of it, which is kind of my job with this podcast. But yeah, you know, what was it? Where were we going with this conversation?
I really don't know. I don't know. I was just basically fanboying over Firaxis, I think, in general. It started off as me doing a just a healthy check-in, and then it spun off into me just slathering them with love and affection. And then I remembered that you guys reminded me what my issue is that's keeping me from Civ 6. That's a personal issue. But I think you're right. I think we're all right here. That is, real life catches up with you. I think especially the podcast is like a whole other thing. It's a whole other entity that kind of keeps me like having to worry about that in some small way versus actually playing a game of Civ 6. So maybe I need just more time.
My favorite Civ 6 experience, and you guys are going to laugh. Favorite Civ 6 experience was watching Voucher's Deity Challenge. I'm dead serious, man. Like, I remember because I would sit there, you know, at work. You know, I'd sit there in the morning, maybe before I'd go to work, and I'd watch it for an hour or two while I was having breakfast or something like that. And for people who don't know, that's how we discovered Voucher. Was he posted on the Reddit that he was going to do this deity challenge, and I stumbled upon it when I was doing some research for the show one day, and I was watching it. And yeah, that's what really kind of taught me more about the game almost than my own personal playing was Voucher day by day going through these civs and playing 5 or 6 hour games, right? That probably allowed you, Voucher, to invest yourself more in the game than maybe either of us did.
Now, I'm honored that that gave you such a good experience. That's really good for my ego. Thank you, Dan. But yeah, I mean, just because I played that so much at that point already and I pushed me so much into the game, it gave me such a good feel for this game. And maybe that's also why I like Civ 6 so much right now, because maybe that small patch into where you have to transition from 5 to 6, I completely rushed through that and got my whole settings up into Civ 6. And so I haven't played Civ 5 in a very long time anymore, even though I thought I would, because I'm so completely focused on Civ 6 that I think I would dislike a lot of things about Civ 5 all of a sudden again.
Ah, that's interesting, Voucher. I also want to add in that Rick Payton on Twitter, one of our little listeners, says the only time he got a game, like one of the memorable ones we're talking about, is when his wife and kids were out of town for a weekend. So again, life catches up with you. I mean, Voucher, can I ask, I don't mean to be intrusive, but I don't see you streaming as much of these deity challenges and stuff. Is that life catching up with you? Is it you?
Yeah, feeling... I unfortunately didn't have the time for it. So I really want to go back to doing more streams, but unfortunately I haven't had the time.
Life. Can we all just sit at home and play games? Like, is that something I can do? Just, you know.
There are people who make a crap ton of money doing that, yes. But unfortunately, I don't think any of us is destined to be one of those people.
And also,
well, maybe
like
if we
work.
Try hard enough, then we can get there as well.
There you go.
You gotta, what is it? You gotta sacrifice to make the dream work.
It is true. I mean, you like my playing, so maybe if enough people do and give me lots of cash, then I can do it for the rest of my life.
There you go, everybody.
Hey, you should do a deity challenge with the four or five DLC civs, man. Just
I still want to complete everyone on camera on deity. It's still in the planning. When I have time, hopefully in September, I will have a bit more time, hopefully again. So maybe we'll start up again.
You heard it here first, folks. Hassle Voucher. No, you have to slather him with affection. That's how he does it. He says his
it
is all ego-based.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yes. Butter him up, everybody. That's how you get a deity challenge out of him. Okay, guys, we are we're already at the 38-minute mark to this episode, Insanity. Do we want to talk about Nubia and experiences? Dan, I think you said you hadn't had a chance for Nubia yet. Is that right? But you watched playthroughs.
Yeah, I was watching playthroughs because I haven't had a chance to actually play them myself because the one post-patch game that I've really gotten into is the Spain game.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah.
Let's pick on Voucher then. Voucher, you've had time. Is that right?
Yes, I think I've completed 3 or 4 games maybe as Nubia right now.
Okay, well, then let's pick on you, because we went top to bottom on them about that week that you weren't there, so 2 weeks ago, and I kind of gave all my thoughts, so I'm going to pull them up while you... What do you... Tell us about them. What are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? Where do you stand?
So, when we first talked about the patch, and I had only done one game as Nubia, I talked a little bit about the Nubian Pyramid and how I thought it wasn't that good, because usually you probably could put something better on the tile that you would normally put it on. And I completely am even more entrenched in that opinion by now. The Nubian Pyramid, it ain't that great. Unless you get that really useless patch of desert around you that you might not want to put a district on, but even then... I just, in the end, never started building the Nubian Pyramids anymore. They were just not worth it. And that's my biggest sadness from Nubia, because the fact that you could get another 20% production towards districts, that's pretty nice. But unfortunately, it's not good enough.
I'm feeling that too.
Like I said before in the episode, I really got a... big feel for range units now, and with Nubia that is just amazing. So I'm still not sure if this will carry over to all my games or just because I played Nubia so much in the beginning, but range units are now a staple for me when I go and fight enemies.
Their Patati archers are awesome.
And the fact that they get like the production bonus, that is the real power. I mean, the Patati archers are great. They're absolutely great. I love the 3 movement on them.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that they get plus 50% production towards ranged units makes it so good. At the point where siege towers are not usable anymore, you then still have your ranged units and you can push them out so quickly compared to your opponents. It's amazing. I love it.
Yeah, I have to say that is really good. Now, are you still using any scouts at the beginning of the game when you have Patati archers that have almost the same sort of movement thing going on? I saw a lot of people saying that they were de-emphasizing scouts for Patati archers.
I kind of don't use scouts in
Ever?
General.
Fair.
Yeah, even in my normal games when I don't have Patati archers, I don't use scouts that often anyway, so I still don't use them.
I'm with you there. I'm not a fan myself, but I thought that was an interesting conversation people were having in that regard.
I mean, I have had games where I build scouts, and scouts have their uses, absolutely guaranteed. I would pick Patati archer above a scout because they are so much more versatile, and they will have so much more uses throughout the whole game in so many different situations that it's just an easy choice for me.
I have to say, I think that they're a good, well-rounded group, that they have their benefits. I mean, like you said, the production and then having the Patati archer has speed increase to them. I just like it. I think that maybe I missed you saying this, and I'm sorry if I did, but did you comment on their extra bonuses when they put a mine over a strategic or luxury resource?
I didn't. And the main thing is, because it's really random, you have to have a little bit of luck about that.
Yeah.
So it's too random for me to build upon. It's nice that you get it, but I just assume like it's not there, so that it will be a nice small bonus, because it is only a small bonus. It's not that much.
Right.
So yeah.
I can agree with that. It is very small. I have to say, in the ones that I played, we did have a lot of hills with some strategic resources and specifically luxury resources. And I know that's just gold, but still the gold was gold at the time and it was nice. Copper Cutters asked on Twitch, do the characteristics of Nubia one-track it to a domination style victory? We kind of talked.
For me, it does.
For Wouter, it does. Okay.
Yeah, it totally does. Their bonus again for range units is such a huge thing. It completely pulls me immediately to that.
So to those lines then, Wouter, 2 weeks ago we were talking about where to put Nubia on a tier list. Then would you put them in the top tier for domination playthroughs?
Yeah, I would put them in top tier for domination.
Wow.
And in for like a general kind of tier list, I would put them probably not S tier, but A tier.
Wow. Well, that's
they're a really,
really
good civilization.
That's great. Yeah, we needed it. We actually wanted to comment on that, and I'm glad you brought it up, Dan, because someone did. Who was this? I want to give a name. It is Paytorb on our subreddit. Actually, went ahead and posted. They said, I previously did the ranked Civ 6 Wonder Google spreadsheet that you guys generously mentioned on the podcast. And he says, I just worked on filterable Civ 6 Wonders to scratch that itch. Is that right?
Oh. That was an awesome spreadsheet.
Did you guys see that? Because it is new. It's up at the top of the list, and it is great. So go check this out. I'm showing it on screen for anyone that's interested in seeing more about this, but it's very cool. Toggle filters. Oh, wow. These filters are intense. I was on my phone, so I didn't get to see them all. But
this is really, really great.
This is great. You can toggle it if you want ones that apply to growth. That's great engineers. Neat. Wow.
This dude knows what he's doing.
He really does. Now, what is this website? Because he said something about the servers can be slow. I have to look into that more. But very, very nice. I like it a lot. Let's see. Can I find?
It's amazing.
Can I find one? What's one? Here's an industrial district. Venetian Arsenal and Roar Valley. Oh, sweet. So you can find exactly what you want when it's adjacent to that district. That is very, very cool. Huge thank you.
I could totally see
it.
Myself using this, pulling it up on my second monitor while I'm playing a game. Like, okay, I know most of the wonders kind of by my head, but still, if I want to like select a couple of wonders by the tags, it's amazing. I could totally see myself using that.
You hear that, Paytorb? You've not only made an amazing list, period, but you made a list that Valter would dual screen Civ with. So that sounds like the true win in life.
Yeah, for everybody listening, go to the Reddit and check that list out because it is a really good piece of work.
Yeah, so civcast.reddit.com will get you there. Let's see how we do. And we have a little bit of, I guess we kind of just have to do kind of closing remarks almost on thoughts on Nubia. Maybe we can do more of a strategy focus to them at some point, or you know, it depends. If you guys have questions on Nubia, we're happy to go into them further. But I think we've all given a little bit of a roundup, Dan, as you get time, no pressure. But once you get into a game with them, we can easily come back and check in on your thoughts once you've had some hands on. But
yeah, I am going to play them this week, or play at least against them, I think was what I said I wanted to do this week. I have set aside time for it, pardon me, to do so.
Yeah, let's do that then. Whenever you get back on with that, we can chat about it. But we are kind of getting to the end here. So I figure, Dan, how about I do toss it to you, and you can tell us if you have a historical minute for this week.
I do. And I'll put on my serious face for a moment here.
Uh-oh.
We are apolitical on this show for right reasons, a video game podcast. I saw some, there were some articles that I read this week that were likening, that they were making reference to the leader for America from Civ 6, Teddy Roosevelt, and some of his more controversial policies from his time on race relations. And you know, history when it comes to Teddy Roosevelt has done a pretty good job of highlighting his strengths and the positive aspects of him and kind of just, you know, setting aside or burying many of the low points and weaknesses of his presidency. And I think that it's an important time to consider a few of the words that Teddy Roosevelt said about race relations, because I have seen him mentioned a lot in the news, on whether it's on Twitter or whether it's through, publications like Newsweek and The Economist and stuff, and referencing him as being kind of a paragon and a forward-thinking and idyllic Republican president. And I wanted to remind people of a few of the things that Teddy Roosevelt said in his time about race in the United States. Specifically, Teddy Roosevelt was quoted at one time as saying that white Americans were, quote, the forward race, and that minorities of all kinds were, quote, the backward races. And he also said of Native Americans, infamously, and the quote reads, I don't go so far as to think that the only good Indians are dead Indians, but I believe 9 out of 10 are, and I shouldn't like to inquire too closely into the case of the 10th. Now, It was a different time when Teddy Roosevelt was president. It was more than 100 years ago. And obviously, we've evolved as a society since then. And we've grown into what hopefully, and I know that recent events might make you think otherwise, but hopefully is a world that's a little bit more mature with how it deals with race relations. Sometimes, of course, we all might question that. But I think, soundly and universally it is generally. But I do think that if people are going to be referencing, Teddy Roosevelt as this ideal or this paragon for presidents that people should look up to and should strive to be, not using names here deliberately, then I think that we need to make sure that we understand the point of view that Teddy took, not just about how great he was for the park system and how strong he was for jobs at the time and how much he worked to centralize the American economy, and but also to spread development west and all that. And I know there are a lot of positive things about him. But Teddy Roosevelt was not, I think it's fair to say, a positive president when it came to race relations. And so if you see his name in the news and you see him as being positively mentioned, there are good things about him, but there are things to put into context with words like that. Because when you hear quotes like the one I gave about his opinion on Native Americans, and of course, his treatment of Native Americans in his time as president is infamous and I guess sad would be the word I would look for, then you should know all the facts and you should know what he said about that quote that I gave about minorities as being, quote, the backward race, and then frame your comparisons, frame your historical signposts as such. I'm not trying to cast judgment on Roosevelt in his time, because it was a different time. It was over 100 years ago. But I think that when you're making equivocations, you need to make sure that you have the whole picture of the individual whom is being equivocated. And that's the picture of Teddy Roosevelt, and just a very minor one in his views on race. You could read some great books on him. After I speak here, I'll quickly look up the one book that I have referenced in my AP US history course about him, because I don't remember what it's called. There are a lot of great documentations on him, and he did many great things. But there are also some things that were definitely more unsavory and are definitely not something to strive to when it comes to making equivocations for presidencies.
Thank you very much for that, Dan. I was debating to say anything on a podcast, but it is a soapbox that I do have, and I want to keep this much as you did, like apolitical, and but it is a very important time for people to be aware of things like that. If you're in the United States and you're aware of the news of what happened last weekend in Charlottesville, it's a very disturbing time where violence is spreading, and the people that are doing it are carrying a historical torch that is very damning. It's something that wound up in the extermination of millions of people. And it's very important, the foundation of why we have something like this podcast and I have Kyle Dempster Studios and all this stuff. It is a very, very positive place. And we've made sure to ally ourselves with great people out there. I always talk about that group, Non-Toxic Gaming, who's always trying to make very positive streams. And they keep a list of people. Their partners are people that if you go to their stream, you know you're not going to be harassed based on your sexuality, gender, any religion, creed, whatever your thing is, you're not going to be harassed by them. And I just want to make that very clear that we are very, very proud to be part of groups like that, where if you come into our streams or if you, are commenting on our subreddit, just know that we have your back. We're not here to judge you based on any of your whatever makes you different than somebody else. We are here to support that and make you feel welcome. And again, I wasn't sure if there was ever really a good fit to have that sort of conversation on a podcast like this, but I think nowadays more than ever, it's important to make people know that, because there is a podcaster that I grew up listening to. And when I say grew up listening to, this was when I was 14 and in high school, and he actually made a post on Facebook, a longer one related to Charlottesville, and how he thinks that a lot of those people that are now 25, which I am, he thinks that a lot of those people that are in Charlottesville promoting such hatred are people that grew up in darker corners of the internet, like kind of like the modern 4chans of it, where you could spread racism through memes and no one was supervising you and your parents didn't understand what the internet was and there weren't mobile phones like there are now that you have quick internet access. And one of the things I commented back to him is I said, you know, high school is a really tough time for people. Notoriously, they said, you know, I realized the world was a much better place because of the communities that you were building online that were very welcoming and accepting of, you know, everyone. And I think that's just important. I think it's important that we all do our part to make everyone feel welcome and that they have a safe place, because there are regions, very many regions in the United States that, you know, if you're not necessarily in the online sphere, if you're just talking to people on the street, they are very bigoted against you. So, like I said, I guess the moral of this story is if you're here, just know that you're a very welcome part of our community and know that we expect that from you in exchange. You know, we want you to be positive role models for others. We have a zero tolerance policy when it comes to people being assholes, for lack of a better word. You know, just we want you to be as inclusive as you can. And the positive spin on this is that that's all I've seen. You guys have been great. Our subreddit is not filled with slanderous filth. I don't have to go in there and moderate because you guys don't post it to begin with. And I have full faith that if there was something like that, you guys would flag it anyway, because that's just the sort of community that, you know, you've all helped build here. So, Dan, I really like that. Valter, I'll let you take this into a more positive light, but I think that that's just something important to put out there for everybody, that we value you no matter who you are, and our door's always open for you. So, Valter, strategy, sir.
Yes. Well said to both of you. That you both said exactly the way I feel as well, so I don't have to reiterate that. But for today, my strategy tip will be talking about Pericles of Greece, of course. And I think it's quite nice that we actually came to Pericles right now, because they in the patch got a nice boost as well, as Greece did. Because the change is that when you build an Acropolis, you will get one envoy when it is completed. And of course, that makes a lot of sense to me. I think I've said it when we talked about the patch notes as well. Greece is a city-state-like country. And if you think about Greece in the ancient times, when Pericles was kind of big, then it was very much so that they ruled over a bunch of city-states, not a true unified nation. And that complements well his Surrounded by Glory. I love that name as well, actually. It gives you plus 5% culture per city-state you're the suzerain of. And so it becomes so much easier to get the suzerain of those city-states, even on higher difficulties, because before you were always like struggling getting enough of those city-states, because the AI would just stack up faster in the civics tree, which meant that they would go faster into better governments, which means that they have more envoys, and therefore you kind of lag behind on that. But you just now can build a bunch of Acropolis, and you will get more envoys and actually rush through their suzerain status before they get there and get that 5% culture bonus to actually stay ahead of, or at least on par with the AI as well. So that's a really nice combo. And of course, one of the biggest powers that Greece has is Plato's Republic. The one extra wildcard policy slot in any government is amazing. You can put whatever you want in there, and it's so, so powerful. Usually I use it for economic policies, and I did my last strategy session as well about policy slots, government, and the civic tree and stuff like that. So if you want more about that, you should listen to that. But the extra wildcard policy is really, really, really powerful. The hoplites themselves, not that much of a huge fan of it. I'm also not much of a huge fan of the spearmen. But if you build enough of them, they can become a really powerful army based upon the combat strength is increased by 10 if there's at least one adjacent hoplite unit. So you can make this like nice spear wall to defend yourself or slowly advance towards the enemy and just blow them away. Really helps against AIs like Scythia, who has a lot of horsemen as well. Or if you're going to fight the Mamluks of Arabia, then they actually become quite powerful. But all in all, I think Pericles is still one of the good, maybe one of the top five, maybe I still think, of this game.
Interesting. Top five, huh?
Yeah, I think so.
Well,
wow.
These lists continue to change. So thanks to everyone that's taking the time to revise them. Again, PayTorb, thank you very much for this one. I keep telling them I need to combine these into a list. Like I should honestly just make like a Google spreadsheet with links to all these things just so I have it in one spot. But thank you so much for everyone that puts in all the dedication to it. We love sharing this stuff out. So go give PayTorb some love over on the Reddit. I think I've said it a million times, but how about one more for the record? It is civcast.reddit.com. Nice and easy. Find links. Actually, you'll find links on the one column. You'll find links to all of our other stuff, including our website, which you can find. It is civcastpodcast.com. You'll get links from there to all our other things like iTunes and Google Play and all the other fantastic ways to get shows and to subscribe to us, like Twitch and YouTube and Mixer and et cetera, et cetera. Patreon, a huge, huge, huge thank you to our people that give every month a wonderful donation to the show that keeps all of our servers up and running, helps us get some hardware to keep the show quality high and all that lovely stuff there. That is patreon.com/civcast. You guys are great. We're always looking to add new things to the show, and you guys help us do that. If you are a patron that's over there already and you have access to the cold open, we have a question for you in today's cold open in relation to the book club. So if you're someone that wants is curious about what we're doing with the book club, take a listen to that Patreon episode, or just in general go over, it's on the subreddit, there's a link to it at the top, stickied. Leave a comment if you're excited for that. We're kind of reworking and revamping some things, but I just wanted to call attention that we could use some input from people. So if you are a bookie or book club fan in our community, we want to hear from you. So just give that some love. What else? Email civcastpodcast @gmail.com. That's how you find us. Civcast Challenge wraps up this upcoming Saturday. Dan read it off to the top of the show, but again, more details on Reddit. And I think that's going to do it for us. Is there anything else I want to mention? Hold on one sec. I said Non-Toxic Gaming. Go give them love too. Oh, our Discord is easy to find as well. That's civcastpodcast.com/Discord. Hop in there. We got a lot of people joining the server from different streams I've been doing, but it's a fun way to chat on and offline. So hope to see your lovely faces there. Until next week, everyone, just one more turn. You're listening to CivCast on the Kyle Dempster Studios Network. For more shows like this, visit KyleDempsterStudios.com.